All right, Esther chapter 3.
I guess I can shift over. We're actually more weighted on this side today.
Hey.
All right. Esther 3. And I'm actually going to begin reading at verse 7, because we left off at verse 6 last week. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots, before Haman day after day. And they cast it month after month, till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hamathatha. Couldn't get it out today. The enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you." Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. All right. Last week, we talked about how Mordecai discovers a plot. He uncovers it, tells Esther. Esther goes and tells the king in the name of Mordecai. The plot's investigated, found out to be true, and the two eunuchs who were angry with the king and plotted against him were hung on the gallows. Now, anybody remember what we talked about being hung on the gallows probably actually meant? Being crucified. Basically hung up on a pole of some kind. The precursors to crucifixion. So all that takes place. Mordecai's the hero. And you begin in chapter 3. And Haman is promoted. Haman's promoted. Wait a second. What just happened here? And that's kind of the whole point. Normally, those who are loyal and demonstrate loyalty to the throne in such a manner are rewarded well and rewarded quickly. He was not. Haman was promoted. We have no idea why Haman was promoted. We're just told that he was.
There may be a good hint in verse 9.
Okay.
Get him in a good place.
He's got 10,000 talents.
Yeah, he's got money.
75 pounds per talent.
About. Anywhere from 75 to 120 pounds.
Yeah, so we're talking tons of silver.
That's a lot. Now, you may remember way back, I think I preached it here, I don't remember, the parable of the unmerciful servant. 10,000 talents. If you were to put that into today's
monetary value in gold to be about $25 billion. Now, was it really his money? Who knows? We'll kind of get to that, but seems he had connections and had some money. Had to have some money if he built 50-foot gallows. Norm?
What they keep saying, Mordecai the Jew.
Yeah.
It may be that Mordecai forbid Esther to identify herself as being Jew because they knew he was a Jew, perhaps, and that's why he didn't get promoted.
Well, that could be, but we're not told. That's the only thing. Doesn't seem that Ahasuerus had this thing against the Jews. We certainly know Haman did. Ahasuerus, he just, lived a life of self-indulgence, basically. Self-promotion. So, Haman gets promoted, and not only that, Mordecai refuses to bow down to him despite the king's command. And you do realize that that's actually the second time, this becomes really the second time that a decree empire-wide goes out on account of somebody's disobedience.
First time was Vashti.
King gave a command, wasn't obeyed, edict went out to all the lands. Now this one's a little bit more subtle, and we'll look at this in a bit more detail, but now Mordecai refuses to obey the king's command and refuses to bow to Haman, the Agagite. And as a result, a decree goes out to all the land. Now, sometime in this time frame between when Esther was made queen in the seventh year of King Ahasuerus, we saw that back in chapter 2, we get to chapter 3, verse 7, and we're now in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. And so there you have it. Time has flown by. 5 years. So somewhere this little Mordecai-Haman thing unfolds. Whether it was closer to the coronation of Esther or whether it was closer to the time frame of his 12th year when the edict goes out, we're not totally clear. But, if it wasn't immediately after that the edict took place, that means that Haman was brewing about this for a really long time.
And he's throwing lots of purr.
He's throwing purr and casting lots. They're dice. He's playing dice. Now, we think of dice for gambling, right? We see all the movies at Vegas, and they're trying to throw the dice. Come on, 7. That's fine, whatever. But it's not for gambling purposes. It's for divination. They want to know what in the world the gods have to say. And so they roll dice, and that's how they determine it. Okay, well, that's what happened. So now we get into verse 7. It's the first month, which is the month of Nisan. Now, what is the significance? Well, actually, one other place. We know it's the first month. But verse 12, the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. That's actually quite significant. You might say it is, Christmas Eve, in a sense. What's the major Jewish holiday? The big one. The Passover. The Passover, technically, is on the 15th day. But remember that Jews celebrate, they start their days on the evening the night before. So from everybody else's calendar, the Passover would actually start on the 14th, from the perspective of everybody else's calendar. Which means the 13th is the day before the Jews start their celebration of the Passover. The Passover is a joyous time. It commemorates a joyous occasion where God redeems his people. And on Passover Eve, so to speak, this edict is dated. And so
Jews all around Susa in particular, because, you know, there was no internet back then. It wasn't like this got sent out throughout the whole empire just like that. But certainly around Susa, the Jews that were celebrating Passover, there was probably very little joy. And that is hugely significant. So
Haman knew.
Whether, I don't know. I mean, he just came up with it. He rolled the dice when he got his date and he gathered them. It could be. That's possible. But he already knew it was the first month, and now he's decided he's going to do this. So something triggered him to get it going. You know, as much as he hated Mordecai, he had to have been limited in some ways, because despite his position, he really couldn't touch Mordecai. And, you know, he could have made up any kind of story he wanted, and there is sort of a subtle withholding of information about the people that Haman wants to destroy. But he submits himself to the roll of the dice. Whatever the dice say, that's what I'm going to go with. Despite the fact that he hated Mordecai that much. So, it's rather interesting. Alright, so they cast lots, those little cubes and so forth. Haman then goes to the king in verse 8. There is a certain people. Pretty vague, isn't it? What's that? Or very vague. A certain people. That really narrows it down, doesn't it? A certain people. And it goes a little bit further. There's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Well, that was true of all the conquered lands. That was typical. Not just of the Persians. The Babylonians did it. Well, of course they did it. They're the ones who brought the Jews into exile. The Assyrians did it. You separate them from the land. But notice the middle of the verse. Their laws are different from those of every other people. Again, another tautology, a truism. No kidding. So right now, Haman is just using these subtle phrases in such a way to make it sound like they're worse than they really are. And really, Haman's not saying anything that's not true of any people. All the conquered nations have their customs and so forth. The Jews are no different in that. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws. Well, there's your first clear lie. It was just simply one law that one person did not keep. That was Mordecai. One command to bow before Haman, Mordecai did not keep. Therefore, they're all guilty, let's kill them all. So,
faulty logic, generalization.
Yeah, broad brush generalizations, sweeping generalizations. That's called fallacious argumentation. So, it's misleading. They do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. Now, that's a phrase there that probably should look familiar to you. What else was not in the king's best interest? Remember previously? What's really not in the king's best interest previously?
Putting up with Vashti's behavior?
Yeah, putting up with Vashti's disobedience. So here we've got a parallel, similar things taking place. People with self-preservation and self-desire for respect. You know, all the king's assistants, they said, hey, we've got to make sure our wives still respect us. So they're demanding respect, so this edict goes out. Well, Haman wants this respect. So, out goes the edict. So here again, we see these parallels of some very similar trends in thinking. It is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. Nice, polite way of saying, you got to do something, king. You got to get them out of here. So, now you get to verse 9. Here comes the plan. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those who have charge of the king's business. Now, did Haman have 10,000 talents of silver? I don't know. Most people would guess, and I think it's a very good guess, that the silver would be accumulated after the Jews were destroyed, and that would just be the plunder. But
that's what I would guess.
Yeah, and that's probably accurate. Not to say that Haman didn't have money, but of course, remember, why would this interest the king?
He's in debt after his wars.
Yeah, his failed campaign against the Greeks. Now, that's not mentioned here in the text, but that's a historically known fact. He depleted his funds. His father, Darius, apparently had about 17,000 talents of silver and gold or something. That was pretty much gone. So, hey, well, I can get most of my money back here. Win-win situation for the king. Yeah. So, hey, he does it. That they may, yeah, so for those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasury. And then you get to verse 10. So the king took off a signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. Notice how the author just keeps emphasizing who Haman is. Well, remember from last week, what was so significant about Haman being an Agagite? Goes back to Saul.
Supposed to kill him.
Saul. Right. Saul was supposed to kill King Agag from the Amalekites, and he refused to. Now, some have speculated that Haman was not necessarily truly an Agagite, and that it could just be a pejorative slur, a racist slur, let's put it that way. That's possible, because even further reading this past week, you know, I mentioned last week about as late as 1994, New York Times ran a story about Jewish zealots talking about Saudis as being Agagites. Obviously, that was just simply a racial slur. But even Jewish zealots living in the time of the Roman Empire called the Romans Agagites. So it is possible that it is just a racial slur, but I do tend to think that Agagite is his actual descent, because his hatred is just too intense.
And Mordecai's a Benjamite.
So no doubt he had to know the story. So...
But Saul didn't actually kill him. Samuel did.
Samuel did.
Why would they be so angry at the Benjamites? Was Saul, Samuel...
Well, Saul did wipe out everything else.
Was Samuel of the tribe of Benjamin?
No. Samuel was a Levite, actually.
He lived in the area of Benjamin.
Yeah, he lived up in that region, but he was definitely a Levite.
Well, the Agagites normally would have been considered wiped out
David?
No, the prophet
Samuel.
Samuel sliced him up for bread.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I mean, we saw that in 1 Samuel 15. He hacked him to pieces, is the way the text reads. Yeah, you know, don't mess with Samuel. So you've got this connection here, and notice Haman. You can almost hear the author as he's writing this out. Haman, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And that's a refrain now that we're going to see again and again. Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And so the king says to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you. Now, what's the significance of having the signet ring?
Authority.
Authority. Yeah. It's like having an unlimited bank account. Somebody gives you the PIN number to a, you know, Bill Gates' bank account. Hey, you're all set. Well, anything he wrote, he can sign with that signet ring, and it was simply the signature of the king. That's what it is. Now, you're a Jew living in Susa at the time. The enemy of the Jews now has the signet ring of the king. What's going to go through your mind?
Oh, dear.
Yeah, oh, dear. You know, you think of those who are your enemies. Hopefully you don't have any. Okay, I hope nobody has enemies. But you think of your most hated enemy, if they had absolute power. You know, that really wouldn't make you feel very comfortable, would it? Especially on Christmas Eve. Well, this Passover Eve for the Jews, and no doubt in Susa, there was not much happiness going on during their celebration. Because in verse 12, that's when the king's scribes are all summoned on the 13th day. So that's the date stamped on it. 13th day of the month of Nisan, the first month. The edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples. To everybody. To every province in its own script. And every people in its own language. Google Translate, you know? Anybody ever use Google Translate? It's kind of fun. It's fun to use. That's how I take electronic copies of Hodge's Systematic Theology, which is just peppered with Latin all over it. Just cut and paste in Google Translate. Ah, there we go. Now I know what he's saying. Well, they didn't have this back then, so all these scribes are gathered. They knew the languages of all the peoples. They wrote them out and sent them out. They get sent out. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. And you've probably seen movies or TV shows that take place in many centuries ago. And you see the person write the letter with their quill pen, and they have this waxy substance that they seal it with. And they take a signet ring or stamp that puts the seal on it. This comes from the owner of that seal. Right? Birth certificates even have seals on them. And they're raised now. They're usually just sort of kind of pumped and kind of, well, damages the paper technically, but you see the seal embossed. Yeah, that's the word. They're embossed, and marriage certificates, all these official documents that seal and authenticate the truth or the veracity of something. Well, that's what is being done here, sealed with the king's signet rings. So letters are sent by the couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction. And I love this. You know, you love the way this is worded. It's not simple. To destroy, to kill, and to annihilate. I mean, you know.
If one doesn't do it, you do it the other.
Right.
Kill them to death.
Yeah, kill them to death. And then, you know, do it again.
He's only mostly dead.
He's only mostly dead. Yeah, that's right. Yes, it does. It's true. But it's just remarkable to me that this is in here. To destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews. I mean, just why do you have to put all three?
Piling on.
I guess so, but...
I was looking at you as I used that. Agag was the king of the Amalekites.
Amalekites, yeah.
Sorry. Dyslexic speaking. But I went back and looked at just the tail end of the previous chapter, and it said that King Saul had attached every strong and valiant man. Mm-hmm. Whoever was a good fighter, he would attach them to himself. And then he cross-referenced with 8:1, where it said that he's going to take your strong men.
Yeah.
So in that same section where it was dealing with... him disobeying God, it was because he was keeping the good things for himself,
mm-hmm.
such as the fighters. And he,
right.
So he was basically looking at Agag as a strong force that to attach to himself to build, you know.
Yeah, to help build his
armies,
right.
To help in his army, which meant though that Agag they would have always been subjected under the mm-hmm. Jews.
But he would have had sway then over the rest of the Amalekites because of that.
Right. So that hatred for Haman, if he was that, he was that struggle for authority
mm-hmm.
because that would go back to who's in charge.
Right. That's it.
I just wondered if that was...
So...
That's why he wanted to destroy, kill, and to annihilate.
Destroy, kill, and annihilate. And they are three different words in Hebrew. So it's not as if, you know, there's... I mean, it just kind of boggles mind. I don't know. It's just... Yeah, Michelle?
They have known that in Hebrew, if you say, like, holy, 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 the significance of that, and is he just trying to counter that?
That could be, but they are three different words, so it could have been a semantic parallel for something like that, maybe. But, I mean, you know, if it was really that significant, he probably would have just chosen the same word again and again and again. But,
Die.
That's yeah. Silly, trying to do. Kill.
Well, it could. I mean, it sounds like a, you know, one of those psycho movies or something, and you know, but
it's that classic.
Yeah. So to to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now,
is that like 12 months later that they're...
11 months later, yeah.
That's when they're going to carry it out.
So he's got the decree, but he's content to just wait for the 11 months to pan out.
Because the dice said so.
Because the dice said so.
Well, but King Ahasuerus
mm-hmm.
and Haman, they never come across as intelligent.
No. Ruthless, but not intelligent.
But never.
Right.
Never strategic. I mean... Other than just greed,
yeah,
there's not a lot of brain power.
No.
Going on with these two men.
Correct.
The king and a lot of alcohol involved, it seems, in their yeah. lives constantly.
That's right. And so, you get to verse 15 after the decree gets issued, and the king and Haman sat down to drink.
The king just ordered to kill his own wife, technically.
Yeah, he did. That's kind of the point. But he didn't know that because he didn't know she was a Jew. So...
That becomes the spoiler.
And that becomes the spoiler, that's right. The hidden, little juicy piece of information.
Why don't they know that? I mean, Mordecai's coming up every day. They know he's a Jew. She's coming over there having a nice little chat.
What's their connection?
Yeah.
Well, there does seem to be some indication that there was probably a servant of the queen who acted as a go-between. So probably they did not have direct contact. So even the conversation that they'll later have in chapter 4 when Esther agrees, that there may have been a go-between. So.
Well, because since she was now a wife,
right.
There would have been a eunuch.
That's
there
right.
There would have been the go-between. There would not have been, mm-hmm. upon pain of death,
yeah.
her going. Cause,
yeah. She couldn't.
Yeah.
So.
Why is it that Esther simply just pleads for her life and her people's life, and the king gives up all the chance of getting back his wealth and all that because she asks for her life back. Like, he kind of went all through with getting rid of Haman and really went through all this stuff, but he didn't, as he's so greedy, just thinking about him kind of just throwing all that to the wind so quickly.
Yeah, well, you notice the difference because, well, there's a couple of things. First of all, the king is only going by what Haman told him, a certain people who have different laws than everybody else. Well, that doesn't say too much. What was written in the edict was the Jews, all the Jews, wipe them out. He also didn't know his wife was a Jew. So when he finds out, he becomes enraged because who would dare harm my queen? And that's really what does it.
Or Mordecai who saved him.
Or Mordecai who saved him.
Because if he did, he'd have to find another Vashti.
That's right. One more time.
Kingdoms are not having a woman.
Haman didn't know she was a Jew.
No, Haman had no idea. But he knew that Mordecai was.
Yeah.
So that's where the disconnect is. He had no idea that Mordecai raised Esther as his own daughter, even though they were cousins. No clue.
Maybe he should have done his research.
Not such a bright guy.
Well, for the closed lips of the servants, servants, it would have gone between the two of them.
Right. Yeah.
Did he even know that they were cousins?
No. Well, if he knew they were cousins, he would have known she was Jewish. So.
Chapter 6 is where it gets fun when he has to honor.
Yeah, chapter 6, that'll be fun when he has to honor Mordecai. That's always the humorous twist.
Well, I love the line where he promises her half the kingdom, and apparently at that time it really wasn't worth that much.
That's true, but that is a bit of a cultural thing that we'll talk about. So the way they sort of exaggerate, you can have anything, up to half my kingdom, and it's not really, he's not going to give it. Right? Even if he did still have the money, he wouldn't give it. So, all right, so a copy of the document was issued as a decree in every province. Oh, yeah, and in verse 13, they're sent by courier. So basically the Persian Pony Express goes out. And that's it. I mean, you don't really have any other means of disseminating all this information. So, Norm?
Well, sometimes that statement that seems like exaggeration, like up to half the kingdom, well, when whoever it was that was able to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream, first had to state what it was and then provide the interpretation, would become number three in the kingdom, I think it was.
That depends on who was the one offering the decree.
Right. I think Nebuchadnezzar offered that, didn't he?
And actually, it was Darius the Mede, or Belshazzar was first, and then later Darius the Mede. But Belshazzar, because he offers for Daniel to be third in command, indicates that he was second, not first.
Yes, but if you back up to Nebuchadnezzar had all these dreams that were bothering
him.
And didn't he offer whoever interpreted high place or position?
High place or position, but I don't think he went that far. I don't recall him going that far as Belshazzar did. Which Belshazzar, his promise only lasted a day anyway. So because the Persians came in and wiped out the Babylonians. So all right. So there you have it. A copy of the document issued to everywhere. The couriers go out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, once again. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion.
Yes.
Notice, not the Jews here. It's the whole city. What do you think?
Probably a lot of Jews there.
Well, there probably were.
There were probably a lot of relationships between the Jews and
them. I'm sure.
And they didn't want killed.
And I'm sure just looking at this edict, it's like, kill all the Jews.
Why?
Why?
You don't have a lot of men.
I mean, it's not as though the people didn't understand that most of the time, empire and emperors of kings really had little value of life. So they had no problem, anybody that rebelled or anything like that, go in, wipe them out completely. 20, 30, 50,000 didn't really matter. But you've got this edict to kill the Jews. What did the Jews do? They didn't do anything.
And who's next?
Who's next?
But there's also the postulation that when Esther gave the edict to Mordecai to gather all the people of Susa that were Jews.
Yeah.
He gathered all of the people of Susa that were Jews.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fast. Yeah. So the plan's unfurled. And, the decree goes out. You got to think, from Haman's perspective, I got this in the bag. I can just drink for the next 11 months knowing one day after the other, I'm just going to sit back and it's going to be one day closer.
That doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't. It really doesn't.
I mean, I can't tell the kids something bad's going to happen to them in 11 months and not expect problems to occur over the next 11 months.
Yeah, you would think.
We would, either run away or something else.
Yeah, that's true. But, of course, your parents don't own the whole nation. Right. You know what I mean?
That's our home we do.
In your home, that's true. This was a worldwide empire, right. And there was no place they can go that was not under the king's edict.
Right.
So they couldn't hide. If any of our parents did this, whatever. Call a friend's house. Go to Aunt So-and-so. We're done. Yeah, there you go. No way to get off the grid. There's a way to put it. Michelle?
And now, is this the same time frame as Nehemiah?
About.
Calling the people to Jerusalem. So maybe some of them, he's kind of letting them take a choice. Go to Jerusalem if you want. Don't stay here.
Well, it could be, but Jerusalem was still under the Persian Empire.
Okay.
So, no doubt in Jerusalem, by the time the plot is unfolded and Esther and the king realizes what's going on, there's no doubt in Jerusalem they knew about it by then. It was a couple months later. And I realize that the empire is vast, but by then it's going to get there, the message.
Yeah, because they were building and with one hand and holding a sword in the other.
Yeah. Couriers were going back and forth from Jerusalem to Persia. So there's no doubt that they, by the time it was all unfolded, they had to have known.
That's a really good point.
Right.
Allowing that to spread.
And you think about it, the people continued to build the walls of the city.
Yes.
Despite it.
Then that really shows the faith, because we just did Nehemiah in the fall semester of the Bible study, and I don't think we touched on that aspect of cross-referencing it with the time period of Esther.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes Nehemiah's faith and encouragement even more significant, because not only do they have the nations directly around them that were trying to prevent them from doing that, they pretty much just had a death sentence, here's the day of your execution, this is when it's going to happen. And
did the Jews return in the time of Darius?
Only some did. Even this morning when we looked at the book of Haggai, we kind of reviewed that the first wave back with Zerubbabel, when they were to go in there and start the rebuilding of the temple, or even just get situated there, only about 50,000 went.
And Ahasuerus was Darius' son?
Yes. So, Rihanna?
Do you think that Haman would have wanted, since he wanted respect so much from Mordecai, he would have wanted Mordecai to fear him, so he kind of liked that wait because he knew the suspense would grow and there'd be more fear of them dying?
Oh, I'm sure that was part of it. Yeah. But really, it's because the dice came up. If the dice came up tomorrow, he would have went with it. You don't want to be somewhat disrespectful, but you can almost picture, here's Haman with his dice, and just like somebody at Vegas, come on, lucky seven, and he's just hoping the sooner the better, and he rolls snake eyes, and, gotta wait 11 months. But that's okay, because it's going to happen regardless.
Do you think that he was purposely making the king drunk so he could, kill all the Jews?
I doubt it, because the edict went out, the command went out, then they got drunk. Let's celebrate. This is going to be a great day. The enemy of the kings are going to be destroyed. The certain people, whoever they are.
The king didn't know who they were.
The king didn't know, because he never read the edict.
Well, but the other thing in the conversation was that, why I'm not impressed with King Ahasuerus, that he didn't ask, he didn't clarify.
No, he didn't ask anything.
He didn't ask anything. All he heard was an opportunity for, a Ferengi, prophet.
Yeah.
Prophet.
10,000 talents.
And that was really because he caught his ear first by saying, that it doesn't profit you.
Yeah.
He picked a monetary term.
Mm-hmm.
But in a government this big, it was not at all unusual, and still isn't to this day, for the rulers to trust their ministers.
Yeah, and yet he did blindly.
Well, he didn't even read it after it got passed.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't. He had no idea.
And it wasn't 1,200 pages long.
Michelle?
I'm pretty short to the point.
But the king doesn't even want the money. He tells Haman, keep it.
Well, he gives him some money to start the campaign. But ultimately, you know, Haman promises, here's your return on your investment, 10,000 talents.
There's something I read that says...
Yeah, toward the end, he says, take the money and go and do all that you have said.
What you please with
yeah.
the people. And then the casting of the poor...
Uh-huh.
It doesn't even sound like Haman's doing it. It says they
yeah.
sit in front of Haman. But I find that interesting, compared, like, the Jewish people, they cast lots.
Yep.
But they involve God. They pray to God to give wisdom as to what to do. And it just shows how, without God, how that can get distorted when
yeah.
we've got out.
Well, I think what they're doing is it said they were casting lots before Haman day after day. So it would be like having the witch doctor with their knuckle bones.
That's it.
Come
yeah.
before you and, you know, show me what the bones say.
Come.
So in this, you know, throw down the bones. So in this case, you've got these sorcerers or seers or diviners
yeah.
or whatever coming before Haman, pulling out their mystical
mm-hmm.
dice and casting lots before Haman to show him. So it wasn't like Haman was the guy at the table.
Right,
It was the mystical...
But even still, you
right.
know...
But yes, he's hoping, he's rubbing his hands together.
No doubt. You know, it's like when you see the gamblers and, you know, there's the gambler and there's the beautiful girl that's standing right next to the gambler who's basically trying to get some money herself. And, you know, he's rolling the dice. He's shaking them. Here, blow on these, honey. And, you know, hey, really? Like, that's going to really give you luck. And you've got to figure this is what Haman's doing, standing there. Come on. But God knows. And he, and that's the key thing there. It was God who directed those dice to have it come up 11 months later.
I think that's something I think about when I read Esther, because again, Esther doesn't talk about Jesus and
no.
he doesn't talk, but yet you can see going through it how God, without even being mentioned,
that's right.
was still completely omnipotent and uncharged and in control of sovereignty was
yeah.
there wasn't anything that anybody could do to go against them. Even Esther's finding favor was only probably, you know, because God worked on her character.
Right.
Worked on Mordecai.
And the whole thing with Esther, none of that would have happened. You know, she comes and receives a scepter of acceptance. None of that would have happened had the king not first deposed Vashti 9 years earlier. You know, and you think the Jews, you know, we talked about this, the Jews in Susa at the time when Vashti's deposed, they would have just shrugged their shoulders and say, oh, well.
As you come, as you go.
Yeah, I mean, they would not have seen the significance of that at all. But, obviously, you put all the pieces together, Esther's made queen to replace Vashti, Esther's the one who's, oh, if the queen had obeyed, there'd be no Esther. Well, there'd be an Esther, but she'd just be still in Mordecai's house.
Yeah, but there probably would have been no Haman. Oh, so.
Well, I don't know. Mordecai might have still have acted
possibly.
Like
yeah, I mean, Mordecai still would have hated Haman. Haman, for being the Agagite, would have hated Mordecai and probably would have had an easier time killing him, but we don't really know.
So what about Mordecai disobeying the king? Not
yeah, isn't that interesting? We never
you
see
know.
Anything happen with that.
Well, we do get a smattering of it tomorrow night.
Yeah, a little bit.
The next night.
Yeah, he gets a little bit more ticked off. And you know, the story unfolds and you're thinking, Haman is just not bright. Because his family convinces him to build these gallows, another set of gallows. And go ahead this night, go ahead and kill Mordecai. Well, why didn't he decide that in the first place? All these things, just you read this, and it's almost a sad comedy. The bumbling crooks. I mean, how many of you have seen the movie? I don't recommend it because I actually, on the whole, don't like it. Home Alone?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, the crooks, the guys who are going to rob the house, they're just constantly bumbling and tripping and falling apart. And, you know, this is Haman. This is what you're seeing. It's almost a comedy. So.
Well, what I meant was, as believers, when we're studying this, how are we to think about Mordecai's disobedience to the king Felix? Because later in the New Testament, we're told to render honor where
that's right.
Honor is due. And,
that's...
So if somebody tells us to bow down before someone just as, you know, pay homage to him.
Yeah, and that's where the difficulty lies, because... we did talk about this a couple of weeks ago, but both Esther and Mordecai are presented simply as morally neutral. No judgment whatsoever is passed upon their actions. Concealing her Jewishness, she took the king's food. No doubt unclean food that a Jew could not eat. She spent an evening with the king
before
she became the queen. But there's no judgment passed. That's sort of secondary to the purpose of God's plan and God's providential hand using whatever they were thinking. God still used it to deliver his people. Now think again about the significance of the fact that the edict went out right on Passover Eve. The Passover was a commemoration of God's deliverance, covenantal faithfulness on God's part. And the Jews in Susa reading this edict on Passover, will God deliver us? That's the automatic question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so we, going through our lives, we see things that take place in our lives and we scratch our heads. How am I ever going to get out of this? Even on small scales. You know, all of us at one time or another have lived just paycheck to paycheck, and you're crunching the numbers and you're thinking, I'm never going to make this work. Is God going to be faithful? Yeah, he is. And that's what Esther teaches us. And he's going to be faithful to the church no matter what kind of persecution comes her way. Jake?
Do you think that, you know, Samuel sliced the Agag guy?
Agag, yeah.
Into pieces. Well, he was joyful that he was, like, he was happy that he was there, like, for some reason.
You mean Agag?
Yeah.
Well, he kind of was, because he thought he was going to be spared.
But
he was a little cocky, really.
But do you think like he was like that because he found out that he like had a son or something? That's how.
Well, that was hundreds of years before.
Yeah, I know, this. But it's like generations.
Oh, we have no idea. We're not really told. So, not really told. So.
That's one thing about the scripture. We have more questions than there's answers.
That's right.
More.
And yet, that's where we have to sit back and say, Lord, you have given us what we need. And that's all we need. It's interesting to speculate. It's interesting to make up these questions. But to sit back and say, I don't have all the answers. Forget about this. You know, that's not the approach. The Lord has given us precisely what we need. And nothing more. Because we don't. If we needed more, he would have given us more.
And nothing less.
And nothing less. Not 65 books. Not 67 books. 66. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You scan through Proverbs and the talk of the fool and the haste and all of those kinds of things. And the pride.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The pride. So.
You know, God told Saul to annihilate that kingdom, that whole area, not to leave one person alive. Well, if he hadn't kept Agag alive, Haman wouldn't have been around. Probably Haman had, you know, relations that would have been also, you know, also would have hated the Jews and all. And so he kind of just kept alive a generation of people who hated
him. That's right. And that just goes to show you, one simple act on Saul's part, or non-act on Saul's part, resulted hundreds of years later. You think your actions don't have consequences?
Abraham,
think about that.
Abraham.
Yeah, Abraham.
Ishmael.
And so on. It just keeps on going.
David.
And so forth.
And you, in this story, it's again, it's a Benjaminite and an Agai.
Right.
And even hundreds of years later, God lets him know the cycle of sin.
That's it. History just repeats itself. That's why the author of Ecclesiastes, who probably was Solomon, you read that and contrast that with the book of Proverbs, written by the same person. And it's like there's nothing new under the sun. You know, as my Hebrew Old Testament professor in seminary said about the book of Ecclesiastes, he said, you want to sum up the book of Ecclesiastes? This is how you do it. Life stinks, and I'm okay with it. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. Because at the end of the book, here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. That's it. That's how it works.
Enjoy your meaningless life.
That's right. If you fear God and keep His commandments, there's your meaning.
Yeah.
So. All right. Well, this was a fun discussion tonight. Just the absurdity of some of this. And it just keeps going. It does. I mean, as we'll see the twists and turns and other things happen, the hatred get ramped up. And it just never ends until it finally does. So let's close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we thank You for Your word and what it teaches us, even in the book of Esther, where Your name is not mentioned even once. And yet, despite that, we see Your providential hand working through history to redeem Your people and ultimately lead to Christ. Lord, we pray that stories like Esther and other stories in the Bible describing Your mighty acts would remind us that we are in Your providential hand. We pray that we would trust Your providence, that we would be faithful to Your commands, faithful to You, and be content, knowing that even though we may not understand all the things happening to us, You're not surprised by them, You're not confused by them. In fact, You ordain them. We thank You, Lord, that You are the mighty, wise, and powerful God. We thank You for the blood of Christ, without which we'd have no hope. And it's in His name we pray. Amen. Yeah, that's a good idea.